Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anne Ball and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, people living in South Sudan now have the ability to send and receive money using their phones. The mobile money system is an attempt to help the country's economy after a 5-year civil war took an estimated 400,000 lives. The companies Mgirush and NilePay began providing mobile money service in August. Both have partnered with Zane, one of two mobile service operators in South Sudan. In recent weeks, the streets in the capital city of Juba have been filled with advertisements urging people to start banking from their phones. The companies hope people already using mobile money in neighboring countries like Kenya and Uganda can persuade locals that it is more financially secure than carrying cash. Darius Moby is director of the NilePay service. He said, more than 80% of money in South Sudan is not kept in banks since most of them are based in Juba. He added, mobile money should make access to funds easier for people in rural villages, creating more financial inclusion. He said, this means people can have a bigger part in the economy. However, many problems need to be overcome before mobile money becomes widespread. Many people in the country are unable to read, and many do not have identification documents needed to register with the service. Government officials say only 16% of the population has identification cards. Because of this, people can receive money, but they are charged more to withdraw it and are unable to send cash. Another problem is a weak telecommunications network. Years of civil war damaged or destroyed half of Zane's cell towers, said marketing official Ahmed Hussein. Before fighting began in 2013, Zane covered 9 out of 10 states with almost 400 cell towers across the country. Now, it has less than 200. Zane is trying to increase coverage, starting with major cities such as Juba, Awil, and Bentu. Some local people worry about trusting telecommunication networks. Last year, Vivacell, a popular mobile company, was closed without warning, locking out hundreds of thousands of users. South Sudan's government said Vivacell was closed for not obeying communications rules. Laduwani Kinyi is Director General for the National Communications Authority. He said, the government wants to set up a system that directly gives telecommunication officials and the central bank records. That way, they would not have to depend on companies like NilePay and Mgirush to provide the information. However, some South Sudanese are unwilling to use mobile money. One citizen, Rhoda Fraser, shook her head when asked by a mobile money agent if she wanted to register for the new service. My people are all in a refugee camp in Uganda, she said of her family. Who am I going to send money to here?
The United States and Britain have very different views on e-cigarettes. American public health officials are warning of the dangers of vaping among young people. But British officials consider electronic cigarettes to be a powerful tool for people trying to quit smoking. Britain's Royal College of Physicians tells doctors to promote e-cigarettes as widely as possible for patients trying to give up cigarettes. And Public Health England says vaping is much less dangerous than smoking. In the United States, hundreds of people who vape have been sickened by a mysterious lung illness. Many of them are teenagers. In answer, the federal government and some states have recently taken steps to ban flavored e-cigarettes that appeal to young people. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now recommends that people consider not using e-cigarettes. Dr. John Britton is director of the UK Center for Tobacco and Alcohol Studies at the University of Nottingham. He said the U.S. reaction is complete madness. Dr. Britton added, "The reality with smoking is if you tell people to stop vaping, they will go back to tobacco. And tobacco kills." Around the world, countries have different views on vaping. More than 30 countries ban e-cigarettes completely. Many European countries, including Austria, Belgium, Germany, and Italy, consider e-cigarettes the same as tobacco products. This puts them under tight control. E-cigarettes face fewer rules in Britain as well as in France. In those countries, e-cigarettes are sold as usual consumer products. E-cigarettes arrived in the United States in 2007 and have been mostly unregulated. 3 years ago, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration got the power to oversee their use. Black market illegal sales of e-cigarettes have grown quickly. The FDA's acting commissioner, Dr. Ned Sharpless, recently testified before Congress. Several lawmakers suggested that e-cigarettes should be completely removed from the market. "We do not consider these products safe. We think they have harm," Dr. Sharpless said. "We do not think really anyone should be using them other than people using them in place of smoking regular tobacco cigarettes." I'm Ann Ball.
researchers have developed a long-lasting, environmentally safe substance that can prevent wildfires from spreading. The new fluid is the creation of scientists and engineers at Stanford University in California. A report on their work was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The Stanford team says the treatment could give firefighters a valuable weapon in their battle against wildfires. Wildfires destroy an estimated 4 million hectares across the United States every year. In 2018, the federal government spent more than $3 billion on firefighting efforts, with billions more lost in property damage. Wildfires have been a very serious problem in the western state of California. Last year, the Camp Fire in Northern California became the deadliest U.S. wildfire in a century. State officials blamed the Camp Fire for 86 deaths. Officials say it destroyed more than 18,000 buildings, most of them homes. The new report notes that a large majority of wildfires result from human activities. It says they often start along roadsides, in campgrounds, and around electrical equipment. The researchers sought to find a substance that could be deployed to such areas to stop fires from starting in the first place. Firefighters often use chemical fire retardants to put out fires. Fire retardants are materials that can stop or slow the spread of fires. But firefighting crews currently use them only as a kind of reactive tool. This is because the chemical treatments are not designed to stay on trees or other vegetation for long periods. They can quickly disappear because of environmental and weather conditions. Some of the treatments being used are considered short-term solutions. They protect buildings in the path of spreading fires, but they also lose their effectiveness quickly. The thick liquid tested by the Stanford University team was found to extend the life of the fire retardants without harming the environment. Such a treatment could open up possibilities for firefighters to take preventive actions before fires even start, notes Eric Apple. He helped to write the new report. Apple is a professor of materials science and engineering at Stanford. The treatment holds the promise to make wildland firefighting much more proactive rather than reactive, Apple said. What we do now is monitor wildlife-prone areas and wait with bated breath for fires to start, then rush to put them out. The researchers worked with California's Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, or CAL FIRE, to carry out experiments. In those tests, the treatment was put on vegetation in areas where fires often start. The testing found that the material provides complete fire protection even after half an inch of rainfall, the study said. Under the same conditions, commonly used fire retardants provided little or no protection from fire. The researchers said they continue to test the treatment with state transportation and fire officials. This includes one of the biggest high-risk areas for the start of wildfires, roadsides. Alan Peters is a CAL FIRE chief who took part in some of the test burns. We don't have a tool that's comparable to this, he said. It has the potential to definitely reduce the number of fires. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In our last program, we talked about President Thomas Jefferson's decisions about who would be in his new government. Jefferson was the leader of a new political party, the Republican Party, but not the Republican Party we know today. In fact, Jefferson's party laid the roots for today's Democratic Party. During the election of 1800, the Jeffersonian Republicans struggled bitterly with the opposition party, the Federalists. Jefferson won that election. In his inaugural address of 1801, he said he wanted to work with the Federalists for the good of the nation. But he chose no Federalists for his cabinet. All the cabinet officers were strong Republicans. All were loyal to Thomas Jefferson. Once President Jefferson formed his cabinet, he began planning the policies of his administration.
Jefferson, of course, thought central government should be almost invisible. He saw its prime role as acting as a sort of referee between the various states, and he wanted to keep it to a minimum.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs a Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia. He says Jefferson was especially concerned about the public debt. In the first year of Jefferson's presidency, the government owed millions of dollars. Each year, the debt grew larger because of the interest charged on these loans. Jefferson wanted to balance the budget. Jefferson discussed his financial policy with his two closest advisors. The advisors were Secretary of State James Madison and Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. The men agreed that the government must stop spending as much money as it did under former President John Adams. And they agreed that the government must pay its debts as quickly as possible. Albert Gallatin said, "We must have a strong policy. The debt must be paid. If we do not do this, our children, our grandchildren, and many generations to come will have to pay for our mistakes." Jefferson began saving money by cutting unnecessary jobs in the executive branch. He reduced the number of ambassadors, and he dismissed all the tax inspectors. Congress would have to take the next steps. Most government offices, Jefferson said, were created by laws of Congress. Congress alone must act on these positions. The citizens of the United States have paid for these jobs with their taxes. It is not right or just for the government to take more than it needs from the people. President Jefferson also wanted to cut taxes on the production and sale of some products, including whiskey and tobacco. He hoped the government could get all the money it needed from import taxes and from the sale of public lands. The Federalists were furious. They warned that Jefferson's financial program would crush the nation. They declared there would be anarchy if Federalist officials were dismissed. Most people, however, were happy. They liked what Jefferson said. They especially liked his plan to cut taxes. Jefferson's biggest critic was his longtime political opponent, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as the nation's first Treasury Secretary. Now he was a private lawyer in New York City. He published his criticism of Jefferson in a newspaper he started, the New York Evening Post. In Congress, elected officials also debated the president's proposal to cut taxes. Federalists said it was dangerous for the government to depend mainly on import taxes. They said such a policy would lead to smuggling. People would try to bring goods into the United States secretly without paying customs fees on them. Federalists also said that if the United States cut taxes, it would not have enough money to pay its debts. Then no one would want to invest in the United States again. Republicans said they were not afraid of smugglers. The danger, they said, would come from taxing the American people. There was no need for production and sales taxes. And they said the American people knew it. The Republicans also said they were sure the government would have enough money to pay its debts. The Republicans won this legislative fight. Both the Senate and the House of Representatives voted to approve the president's plan to cut taxes. Congress also had another of Jefferson's proposals to debate. Jefferson wanted to reduce the number of federal courts. The issue had roots in the political divisions between the Federalist and Republican parties, and it started in the closing days of the previous president's term. John Adams was a Federalist. Before Adams left office, Congress passed a Judiciary Act. This act gave Adams the power to appoint as many judges as he wished. The act was a way for the Federalists to keep control of one branch of government after losing the presidency and their majority in Congress in the election of 1800. So President Adams quickly created new courts and named new judges. Just as quickly, the Senate approved them. The papers of appointment were signed. The appointed men were known as midnight judges. However, some of the midnight judges did not receive their papers or commissions before Thomas Jefferson was sworn into office. The new president refused to give them their commissions. Federalist congressmen claimed that the president was trying to interfere with the judiciary. This interference, they said, violated the Constitution. Republican congressmen argued that the Constitution gave Congress the power to create and eliminate courts. They said the former administration had no right to appoint the so-called midnight judges. The Republicans won this argument, too. Congress approved President Jefferson's proposal to reduce the federal courts. Congress then turned to other business. But the question of the midnight judges would not die. One reason the issue remained important was because of a man named William Marbury. Marbury was one of the midnight judges who had never received his commission. He asked the Supreme Court to decide whether the government was required to give him his commission. The Chief Justice of the United States, John Marshall, was a member of the Federalist Party.
Jefferson and Marshall hate each other. In fact, Marshall gives him the oath for the inauguration and goes back to his room and says, well, a terrorist has just taken over the government. I hope we will be able to survive him.
Joseph Ellis is a historian who has written many books about early American history. He says John Marshall was a towering figure who had an entirely different view of the federal government than Jefferson. Marshall believed the Supreme Court should have the right to veto bills passed by Congress and signed by the president. In the Marbury case, he saw a chance to put this idea into law. Marshall wrote his decision carefully. First, he said that Marbury did have a legal right to his judicial commission. Then he said that Marbury had been denied this legal right. He said no one, not even the president, could take away a person's legal rights. Next, Marshall noted that Marbury had taken his request to the Supreme Court under the terms of a law passed in 1789. That law gave citizens the right to ask the high court to order action by any lower court or by any government official. Marshall explained that the Constitution carefully limits the powers of the Supreme Court. The court can hear direct requests involving diplomats or the states. It cannot rule on other cases until a lower court has ruled. So, Marshall said, the 1789 law allowed Marbury to take his case directly to the Supreme Court. But the Constitution did not. The Constitution, he added, is the first law of the land. Therefore, the congressional law is unconstitutional and has no power. Chief Justice Marshall succeeded in doing all he had hoped to do. He made clear that Marbury had a right to his judicial commission. He also saved himself from a battle with the administration. Most importantly, he claimed for the Supreme Court the power to rule on laws passed by Congress. The case of Marbury versus Madison established that the Supreme Court, not the President or the Congress, has the final say on what the Constitution means. Jefferson did not like Marshall's decision, but Joseph Ellis says that Jefferson was awed by how the Chief Justice argued his case.
Jefferson says to his friends, if you ever talk to Marshall, don't say anything, because whatever you say, he will take it and he will twist it. He calls about twistifications of John Marshall.
Jefferson waited for the Supreme Court to use this new power to change Congress's laws. Several times during Jefferson's presidency, Federalists claimed that laws passed by the Republican Congress violated the Constitution. But they never asked the Supreme Court to reject those laws. The case of Marbury versus Madison was one of the most important decisions about how America's government operates. But historians say another act during Thomas Jefferson's presidency affected America in an even bigger way.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.